I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. In a moment, our conversation today, it's with the BBC's Owen Bennett-Jones. We'll ask what's going on in volatile Pakistan. But first, some good economic news today, even as stocks tumbled worldwide overnight and the housing slump deepens. The U.S. Labor Department reports that American employers added 166,000 jobs last month. That's almost twice as many as economists predicted. And the unemployment rate held steady at a 4.7% for the second month in a row. But as we said, that news comes at the end of a jittery week that included an interest rate cut intended to shore up financial markets. So joining us to put this week's economic news in perspective is Zanny Minton-Beddoes. She's Washington economics editor for The Economist magazine. Zanny, how would you characterize the economic news?
Well, I think you had the right word in your introduction, jittery. The markets are jittery and the news has been... Well, some of it's been pretty good and some of it's been mixed. And as a result, no one really knows what to believe. And I think basically, if you look forward, the news is worrying. And if you look back, the economy's been more resilient than we thought. So depending on which you put more weight on, you are worried or not so worried.
Let's start with the Labor Department numbers. Unemployment holding steady, jobs added in some industries like business services and hospitality. So looking out, is that trend expected to continue?
Well, I think most people feel that the economy is really slowing. We had a blockbuster growth in the third quarter, the first figures we just heard this week of 3.9% over the summer, which included the beginning of the credit crunch. But now we see this very big weakness in housing, and we've had a lot of numbers suggesting that housing is getting worse. And the big worry is that at some point, this decline in home prices and weakness in the housing market is going to translate into the consumer spending less. We've also got oil prices near record highs, and all of that will ultimately weigh on consumption. And that's the kind of big question mark. How much is consumption going to get hurt?
Well, when you mentioned housing hurting, along with the good numbers today, the Labor Department also reported that the construction industry cut 5,000 jobs last month.
Yeah, but that's actually relatively little. I mean, the surprise, in fact, has been how little there has been in the construction industry thus far. And the surprise from these numbers, or the good news from these numbers, is the resilience outside of construction. I mean, we have really two economies right now. We have a major recession in housing and everything to do with housing, and we have really strong growth everywhere else, particularly exports. Exports over the summer were absolutely booming. That's partly to do with rip-roaring growth in the rest of the world, but that's really helping the U.S., and the question is whether this two-tier economy can continue, and I think it really ultimately depends on the consumer, and if the consumer slows down sharply, then we are headed for a really sharply slower growth or even recession, but right now we don't see much evidence of that.
Right, but as you said, the concern is that the housing problems will bleed over into the other tier of the economy. Well, with that in mind, there was a quarter-point cut in interest rates this week intended to boost the economy. In an article you wrote for The Economist, you wondered whether Federal Reserve Chair Ben Bernanke could be seen as a pushover for cutting rates again, whether it was a faint-hearted move. What do you mean by that?
Well, I think I started the article by saying far-sighted or faint-hearted, ? And there are two ways of interpreting it. There are plenty of good reasons to cut rates now. One is that monetary policy is not especially loose. Two is that, as we've been discussing, it really looks as though the economy is likely to slow quite sharply.
So this cut would put more money in play. It would be easier to borrow money. Money would be more accessible.
That's right. Lower interest rates will help boost the economy for all those reasons. The reasons for having lower interest rates now is, one, you've got this probable weakness ahead, quite serious weakness. You've also got inflation pretty much under control. It's it's sort of well within the comfort zone that the central bankers care about. So you don't have to, on the face of it, worry too much about that. And monetary policy is not particularly loose, so it's okay to cut a little bit more. And at the same time, you know, the credit markets, the source of all this turmoil in the past couple of months, are still pretty fragile. If you just need to look at what happened yesterday, you know, major banks announcing that they're likely to have, weaker results. There's a lot of nerves out there. So there are good reasons to cut, but at the same time, there are two things that worry me. One is that it's beginning to look a bit like when the markets expect the Fed to cut, the Fed will oblige. And it looks as though there's a risk that they fall into the trap of being reactive. So if the markets expect lower interest rates, the central bank will provide them. And that's not a good position to be in. And the second is that if you look at the jobs figures today, if you look at the third quarter growth figures, the economy has actually been extraordinarily resilient. And you also see oil prices near record highs, the dollar falling to record lows. Those are potentially inflationary risks out there. And so there really is a risk that they take their eyes off inflation and worry too much about potential weakness in the economy, which may not happen.
Washington Post columnist Stephen Perlstein seems to agree with you. He writes that Bernanke is putting the short-term interests of big banks and investment houses before long-term interests of the global economy, which I think is repeating what you just said. Zanny Minton-Bedos, Washington economics editor for The Economist magazine. Zanny, thanks so much.
My pleasure.
To Pakistan now, where the upcoming election and the future of possible candidates, President Pervez Musharraf and former Prime Minister Benazir Bhutto, are in question. As you know, Bhutto recently returned to Pakistan after nearly 10 years in exile. She was met by adoring crowds and a devastating twin bombing. She left again yesterday. A spokesperson says she's visiting family in Dubai. General Musharraf is waiting for a Supreme Court decision on whether he can run for president, and there are fears he may impose martial law if the decision goes against him, using recent violence as an excuse. Well, joining us for a conversation about Pakistan, someone who's been on the ground there quite a bit, most recently with Bhutto when she returned, BBC NewsHour host Owen Bennett-Jones. He joins us from London. Owen, welcome.
Thanks very much.
You've seen Pakistan in trouble before. In fact, the title of your book is Eye of the Storm. How would you characterize the situation there today?
Oh, it's very fragile at the moment, no doubt about it. There are lots of people trying to work out what to do over the next week or two. The Supreme Court have to decide whether or not Musharraf's candidacy for the presidency was valid or not. If it is not valid, they're saying he cannot be president. I don't think he could accept that. General Musharraf is faced with how does he hang on to power for another 5 years. If the court goes against him, martial law presumably, but he may think he doesn't want to do that after the court has made its decision, directly defying the court, as it were. He may prefer to do it before the court, using, as you say, the security situation as the pretext for that. Then you've got the democratic politicians, Benazir Bhutto, Nawaz Sharif, waiting in the wings, hoping to get power. It's a three-way struggle, Musharraf, Bhutto and Sharif. It's about 3 months now before we'll know who's on top.
And the immediate timing is that Musharraf's term ends, is it November 15th?
Yeah, I mean, that's right, his term as president. I mean, he has actually been re-elected. It was a very weird decision that the Supreme Court made, which was that his election could go ahead, but the result wouldn't stand until they thought about it. And they're thinking about it now, and we're trying to work out when they're going to make their decision. It was going to be something like the 12th. Now they're saying they're going to be hearing the case on Monday and Tuesday. So it's imminent. And this is a decision which could spark martial law.
Well, when you say fragile, I just want to be clear. What do you mean by fragile? Because we've seen unrest in Pakistan before. What do you mean by fragile?
I mean, two things. The political class is in turmoil. The elite that run Pakistan, and it is only a very small group that have ever run Pakistan, they're at a phase now where it's not clear who's going to be on top in a few months' time. So there's a struggle going on. So that causes great confusion amongst the political classes. But also, on the ground, there is a desperately serious situation. Since August, 300 soldiers have been held hostage by Waziri militants. It is an amazing situation that the army is too weak to release its own men in Swat, which is not so far from Islamabad. I mean, for goodness sake, I used to go skiing in Swat.
It was a tourist area.
Right. I mean, not this year. They've got a militant guy there who is killing soldiers. And they've used helicopters to attack him. This is not far from Islamabad.
We're looking at a picture, in fact, on the front page of the New York Times, of an armed militant standing on the street in this area in northwest Pakistan, where militants, as you say, have drawn a new front in the insurgency against the government, a radical cleric taking control in this district. It's a pretty striking image.
It wasn't so long ago that if a soldier was killed by any of these militant groups, they would know about it. The army just would not tolerate, and they would be dumped on from a very high level. And they would really feel the pain. The army's too weak to do that now.
And also, you know, we understand that there's a starved civilian apparatus, is how it's being defined. You know, schools and hospitals failing. There's just no backbone for a counterinsurgency, no will for that. So, you know, it seems like an entire country without the sort of backbone a country might need.
Yeah, it's not a good situation. I mean, to be fair, the situation with the schools and the hospitals and all, and the administration of justice, importantly, none of which are functioning very well. That has been the case not only under the military, but also under the democratic governments of Nawaz Sharif and Benazir Bhutto. You know, it is a fact that if you go to a village in Pakistan, I do this for most of my trips there just to sort of see what happens, go to a school in a village, the teachers won't be there. I mean, more often than not, teachers are missing. It's absolutely sickening. You see these children who are there ready to go, wanting to learn, and the teachers can't be bothered to turn up because they're paid very little, because they've been politically appointed, they live far away, whatever the reasons, it just doesn't work. But that is not something that you can blame on the military. That's been going on under the democratic governments too.
Oh, and this is a country that is nuclear, you know, armed with nuclear weapons, a neighbor to Afghanistan. So again, I go back to the word fragile. What do you think? There's going to be revolt? What do you think might happen?
Well, I mean, there's so much uncertainty at the moment. It's quite difficult to work it out. I mean, one possibility is that there'll be martial law, and I think there would be a kickback to that, and people would object, and there would be problems on the streets. So that's one sort of scenario that you can see ahead to. But the more serious thing, I think, is the growth of the Taliban. I mean, it is, let's put it into context, it's just in Northwest Frontier Province. It's one of four provinces. The most important province is Punjab. It's not happening there yet. It is mainly in the tribal areas, which have always been pretty lawless and where federal law doesn't actually apply, even formally. So, you know, there are sort of, you know, qualifications to put on this, but it is spreading. And the army doesn't seem to be able to deal with it.
And into the situation wades Benazir Bhutto with her recent return. Did she, maybe unwittingly, maybe purposefully, I don't, your opinion, did she make the situation worse?
Well, it depends what you think is the best outcome. I mean, she says she's going to restore democracy and she wants to stand in elections, that's for sure. And if you think democracy is the answer, then, and the Americans do, and that's what Washington is saying, it's what London is saying, that there should be a more democratic element to the Musharraf regime, then, OK, she's contributing. If you think that her attempt is just actually to get power, that the corruption allegations that were made against her in her last two terms, and don't forget she was dismissed both times on amidst corruption allegations, and if you think that's got more to do with it, then you can't say that she'd be making a great contribution. So, I guess if she gets into power, I'm not sure she will, actually, but if she gets into power, we'll have to see how she performs.
If she doesn't, I mean, can you envision that scenario as well, with so many thousands of people, you know, with such a fragile, volatile situation and so many thousands of people banking on it?
Well, yes. I mean, the Pakistan People's Party can organise a demonstration like no one else, and they've been doing it for decades. And, you know, the way that works is that if Benazir Bhutto gives a parliamentary slot to some local sort of chief out in the stick somewhere, then the part of the deal is that when she needs a couple of busloads of supporters, that he pays for their food and lodging and gets them down there. So, I mean, you know, I'm not saying there wasn't genuine enthusiasm for her, but that sort of show can be purchased, and you know, it doesn't mean that if she loses the election there'd be any... Yeah, I mean, you put it like this, in the polls she's around 30%.
The BBC's Owen Bennett-Jones. We're going to take a quick break. When we come back, more on those corruption allegations against Benazir Bhutto. Also, can the U.S. call off General Musharraf's plans for martial law? And later today, here in the U.S., State Department workers are refusing to serve in Iraq. Officials telling them today, you go where you are told. We'll speak with a former diplomat who did go. We'll get her view. Back in 1 minute, here and now. We're back with more of our conversation with the BBC's Owen Bennett-Jones about what he calls the very fragile situation in Pakistan. He was there recently covering the return of former Prime Minister Benazir Bhutto. Owen, we want to speak about the U.S. role in Pakistan. Admiral William Fallon, the senior American military commander in the region, is there today meeting with President Pervez Musharraf. And this is obviously a sticky situation for the U.S. Pakistan, a close U.S. ally, first in fighting the Soviets in Afghanistan, then fighting against the Taliban and the war on terrorism. Critics say the U.S. looked the other way, though, when Musharraf, for instance, built a nuclear Pakistan, or perhaps didn't fight the Taliban as he might have. What are U.S. interests here?
Yeah, well, the Americans have got two interests, I guess. I mean, you know, I'm sure they've got many more, but two big interests in Pakistan: security and the promotion of democracy. And I don't think there's any doubt that their support for General Musharraf indicates that they have put security above the promotion of democracy, although they'd like both to be achieved. Now, when it comes to security, they have put a lot of pressure on General Musharraf to fight these militants on the Afghan border in Waziristan, and he has done it. I mean, he has done everything that has been asked of him, and it hasn't worked. They've lost control of Waziristan.
To the extent that, as you remind us, because I think Americans forget that there are 300 kidnapped Pakistani soldiers.
Right, and I mean over 1,000 have been killed. Yeah, this has been a very fierce battle, and frankly, they've lost control of the area. So I think there's some bitterness in the Pakistan army that they've done this, basically. You know, as they would say politically, they've had to say it's in their own national interest, but it has also been under significant US pressure, and it's backfired on the army.
Well, Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice, when asked if she or President Bush had directly advised Musharraf not to declare martial law, as you're saying, might happen in advance of a Supreme Court ruling on his future run for president, Condoleezza Rice said she wouldn't speculate on developments in Pakistan or divulge details of their conversations. In your opinion, would he listen if the U.S. asked him not to declare martial law?
Yeah, I think he would. I mean, I think he did. Back in August, there was a talk of martial law. And, you know, and when I say talk, you know, there was a high-level meeting in Rawalpindi of the military, and they were thinking about it, and Condoleezza Rice rang on that occasion and spoke, and it didn't happen. I'm not saying it was the only reason it didn't happen, but I'm sure it was a factor. The Americans are paying Pakistan an awful lot of money. I haven't actually got the figure for you. I'm trying to work it out myself, and a lot of it's in hidden budgets, so it's quite hard, but it's billions a year that Pakistan is receiving from the United States. So there's no question the United States does have leverage. And if they say, we really do not want martial law and everything will stop in terms of the flows of money, then I'm sure that would get people's attention in Rawalpindi.
Oh, and in the time we have, I want to ask you again about General Musharraf and Benazir Bhutto. You reported on the deal that they made that reportedly drops the corruption charges against her. In exchange, she would come back and maybe broker a power deal with him. She had been accused of making tens of millions of dollars when she was prime minister. You spoke to a leading Pakistani journalist about this. This is Kamran Khan. Let's listen to what he said.
These cases, they are using it now for a major and final bargain with Benazir, and all these cases are being washed away, and the cases are being withdrawn, and this was not possible in the law. They are doing it through an ordinance, which is unprecedented, which is exceptional.
You report that there are corruption cases against Benazir Bhutto that are still active in Spain and Switzerland, but you also earlier said that, you know, other courts discounted them. So what's your sense of whether, you know, these corruption charges are true?
Well, all I can say is this, that the court in Switzerland that heard evidence that she'd received and her husband kickback money from government contracts, the magistrate there did convict her. But Benazir Bhutto insisted on her innocence and challenged that case. And it is now being reheard. So that conviction, to that extent, doesn't stand. In Spain, she's being investigated for money laundering, although the Spanish authorities are saying very little about that case, but it is still an active investigation. In Pakistan, all the cases against her have been dropped, and that is because of this ordinance, save possibly one. The National Accountability Bureau there last year said that it wanted to charge her with involvement in the oil for food scandal.
In Iraq.
And in Iraq, yeah, kickbacks to Saddam Hussein's regime, allegedly. She has not faced that charge in Pakistan yet. And it's quite interesting because the ordinance that General Musharraf signed doesn't cover the date that alleged act happened. So I did ask General Musharraf about a month ago, would he charge her on that one?
In fact, we have some of that sound. Let's listen to his response.
All that I'm saying is we will abide by that document strictly. That is all that I'm saying.
Right. And so if it's not covered by the document, it's not covered.
Obviously, if it's not covered in the document, it's not covered.
Yeah, just to give the context of that, he's sort of saying, you know, basically the implication of that is that they would go ahead and charge, although clearly he wasn't on top of the detail, and I think basically he didn't want to say that he was going to charge her because the political deal is that he won't. So there are, you know, there's all this stuff around. She denies any wrongdoing, always has denied wrongdoing, has always appealed any cases against her, and that's where it lies.
We just have a few seconds with Owen Bennett-Jones. You've told us that you think it's a very fragile situation in Pakistan, possible unrest if General Musharraf push back against martial law, if General Musharraf declares martial law. But as you travel through the country, what's your sense of the mood of the country? Is it one that's becoming more hunkered down, more conservative? What's your feel?
Well, there are more conservative, religiously conservative people around, but the main point to make is this, that many Pakistanis live in poverty. That is their main concern. Most Pakistanis are very moderate. They do not have extreme opinions. They've been extremely badly served by their leaders for 50 years. They've had really very few opportunities to live reasonable lives for themselves and their families, and they're sick of it.
BBC NewsHour host Owen Bennett-Jones speaking to us from London about the situation in Pakistan, a country he's become very familiar with. Owen, we thank you as always for your time.
It's a pleasure. Thank you.
And we want to tell you about some of the stories we're working on for you for next week here and now. The drought in the southeast. We're going to speak to a small town mayor in Tennessee. His residents can only turn on their taps 3 hours a day. Also, the best-selling novel, The Life of Pi, is now out in an illustrated version. We'll speak to author and illustrator about the challenges of putting in picture what had been fantastic mental images. And as the Sex Pistols hit the road again, we remember the punk rock movement before it went mainstream. That's just some of next week's fare on Here and Now. Hope to see you then. Still ahead today, Brazilian singer-songwriter Seo, Here and Now. U.S. Ambassador to Iraq Ryan Crocker is telling U.S. diplomats if they don't want to put their nation's interest over their own safety, they're in the wrong line of work. He also said today that joining the Foreign Service doesn't mean you get to choose the fight. Crocker's comments came after a tumultuous week at the State Department, with some Foreign Service officers revolting over a new policy that would mandate assignments in Iraq. The State Department plans to send 250 Foreign Service officers to Iraq next summer, but only 200 have volunteered, so 48 more might be forced to go or be fired or otherwise disciplined. The diplomats are being asked to work in the Baghdad embassy or in the field with the military on provincial reconstruction teams, or PRTs. Kiki Harris worked on a PRT from April of 2006 to this past January. She came out of retirement to take that post and joins us now. Welcome.
I'm glad to be with you.
Why did you go?
Patriotism. I was not in favor of the war. My colleagues and I all thought it was not going to happen. It was so improbable. But we went into it. We created a situation, we created a mess, and it's our duty as Americans to try to clean it up.
Well, interestingly, Ryan Crocker, the ambassador, wasn't in favor of the war either. He feels it's the duty now of Foreign Service workers to go. What do you think?
I am, in fact, in favor in principle of the worldwide availability policy. That is, Foreign Service officers should be available to go wherever their country needs them. The problem here is not that. The problem is that people are being asked to do something that they're not prepared to do, especially on the PRTs, and that, in fact, because of the violence and the situation there and the short terms of assignments, they can't do well.
Tell us a little bit about these PRTs so we can understand your point of view. We understand the provincial reconstruction teams, there's over 24 of them in Iraq, are sent out to the provinces to help Iraqis rebuild. What was your mandate as you understood it, and what did you immediately run up against?
Well, my mandate as I understood it was to be in general charge of all the reconstruction activities in the province of Diyala, Bakuba is the capital, and also of working with the provincial government to foster a democratic form of government that was decentralized rather than having everything happen from Baghdad.
Is this what you were trained for, by the way? I mean, a lot of this is real bricks and mortar and, you know, bringing water in and building homes. I mean, is this what you were trained for?
Well, I wasn't exactly trained for it, but since I'd been in Sierra Leone and Tanzania, I had worked in both democratization and economic building activities. Not always the bricks and mortar.
It sounds as if you were prepared for this. Why would you say that a Foreign Service worker might not be prepared for this?
Because most of them have not managed a large organization with budgets, although one of our problems, of course, was that we had no budget, no money when I arrived. Most of them have not engaged in democratization activities. The work of Foreign Service officers generally is negotiating with foreign governments to try to bring the foreign governments into postures that support the United States position on various treaties in the UN, that do treaties with the United States, not getting out and teaching people about democracy. It's negotiating with foreign governments.
Well, we asked Sean McCormick, who is Condoleezza Rice's chief spokesperson, about that lack of training. Here's what he had to say.
That's part of a change and changing world, is adapting to it. We are changing along with it to meet the demands and the needs of a different kind of diplomacy in the 21st century.
Kiki, what does that shift mean to you? What do you hear there?
I hear two things. The more Iraq-focused thing is that people need to change to meet the needs in Iraq, and that is fine, except that it takes more time than they have. A year's assignment, we know that in most countries, in a regular embassy, it takes 3 to 6 months to really get up to speed. Iraq is not most embassies. There's no institutional memory. There are very few records kept. So by the time somebody gets up to speed and learns the job, they're leaving. The other thing is a more general posture about diplomacy, which is that the United States should encourage countries to be more like us, encourage countries to have governments that we like. I'm kind of divided about that. I love our government. I think we have the best kind of government, but I don't know to what extent diplomats really ought to be messing in the affairs of internal affairs of another country.
Diplomats as missionaries.
Yeah.
Almost. Well, the Special Inspector General for Iraq Reconstruction, Stuart Bowen, released his report recently assessing the PRT programs. He says there's been incremental progress, but on things like whether Iraqis understood, the rule of law, the role of police or the courts, or governance, whether they could self-govern, or whether they could manage their own budgets, these were big issues still. There has been some success in the Al-Anbar province. But it's interesting. Boston Globe reporter Farah Stockman found some of the same problems that you found when she tracked the work of a reconstruction team in Afghanistan for 5 years. For instance, a team might be there for 1 year, and they may secure the permits to build a women's center, but then they leave, turn the project over to their replacements, and so far the center hasn't been built. That kind of a breakup of the process.
That is a real hazard. The other problem is the military posture. The U.S. military posture, the American officers are given an enormous range of latitude in how they carry out their mission, which is necessary when you're prosecuting a war. When the battle is primarily political, it becomes a problem. So the 1st Battalion we were with was very much in the negotiating, trying to reach out to the opposition candidates mode. The battalion that replaced them was much more toward, we're going to fight this war and win. That battalion has now come around to the 1st Battalion's posture, but it took them a year. And in that year, almost everything that we had done was destroyed.
So this is forcing foreign service workers, diplomats who like to work diplomatically, to sometimes perhaps work alongside military that don't have the same mindset.
Well, the military in many ways set the agenda because they have the resources. One of the problems of the PRTs is that the PRTs have very few resources. When I arrived, we had, in fact, no operating budget, and our motto was, if it's not nailed down, it's ours.
Well, Kiki Harris, I just want to address one other thing that the foreign service workers are saying very loudly this week, that they're worried about the danger.
I have mixed feelings. There is danger. If I were a military person, I would have 2 combat action medals for being in the midst of combat.
But isn't that just...
On the other hand, we do serve in a world that's dangerous, and we sign up for things good or bad.
And still, we should say you did leave with some health problems, but out of frustration as well?
Stress-related health problems, and part of the stress was frustration. The health problems were real. They went away when the stress was removed, thank goodness. But it was also clear by the time I left that I couldn't do anything that was constructive.
Kiki Harris, a now retired Foreign Service officer who came out of retirement to work on a provincial reconstruction team in Iraq. Kiki, thanks so much for speaking with us.
Thank you.
And by the way, if you want to listen to yesterday's related story on the uproar at the State Department, just go to our website and click on Archives. That's here-now.org. Before we go today, Seo means heavenly in Portuguese, and they say Seo makes heavenly music. You be the judge in just a few minutes here and now. Ah. On Sunday, the New England Patriots take on the Indianapolis Colts, and at the end of the day, there will be only one unbeaten team left in the National Football League. Here to talk about what's being called the midseason Super Bowl and other sports news, Bill Littlefield, host of NPR's Only a Game. Hi, Bill.
Hey, Robin.
People say, oh, no, we thought we were just over the Red Sox. She's moved on to the Patriots, but we can't help it.
It's sports
they're unbeaten.
In 2007.
And here we go again. Quarterbacks Tom Brady and Peyton Manning going head-to-head. Who looks better in GQ? Oh, no, wait.
No.
You mean football.
No, wait. Football.
The Colts beat the Pats the last three times these teams met, including last January's AFC Championship game. So what do you think this time around?
Well, just to set the stage for this game, I talked to a columnist in Indianapolis a little earlier this week, and I asked him if he thought that the fate of the world rested on this particular game, and he said I was understating the case. So, you know, hype is the name of the game in professional sports these days. We all know that. And many, many, many of us have been drawn into it either by participating directly or making fun of it. And so far, it's been great fun. My only worry is that the game will be in any climax, as is so often
right.
the case with these things.
To who gets more advertising, Tom Brady or Peyton Manning, you know, in
right,
the future.
Exactly.
Well, on to basketball. The National Basketball Association season got underway this week. And before the opening whistle blew at the Staples Center, L.A. Lakers superstar Kobe Bryant was booed by his hometown fans. My nephew here in Boston will be appalled. He loves him. But why the booing?
Well, I think partly because Kobe Bryant has been making a lot of noises about being traded somewhere else, wanting to play somewhere else. I wonder, though, if some of the dismay may be simply a result of the amount of power that Kobe Bryant has. He not only gets to say where he'll be traded to, should he actually agree to a trade, he also gets to say who remains on the roster of the team that he goes to. Mm. He'll say, yes, I'll go to the Bulls, but only if I can sort of pick who remains on the Chicago roster. Well, this is an extraordinary amount of clout for a player to have, and I think fans may be at the point where they're just saying, well, you know, this is too much is too much.
Well, not to mention other teams. Don't bring them here.
Right,
you
right,
know?
Exactly.
And just quick, who do you think looks strong coming out of the gate?
Well, I think there are a lot of teams that have been strong and will remain strong. San Antonio, of course. Dallas looks good. Phoenix looks good. In the East, Detroit looks better. Chicago looks better. And, happily, the hometown Boston Celtics have a couple of new faces,
right.
Kevin Garnett most importantly, and they may be a contender at least in the East.
Everybody outside of Boston just said, oh no, the Celtics too. but speaking of Boston, we just have to briefly mention there was some big rally here this week for some sort of World Series something or other. But
it happens so often now that we don't get that excited about it.
I know. But former New York Yankees manager Joe Torre heading west to head the Los Angeles Dodgers, Yankee Uber closer Mariano Rivera, pitcher Annie Pettit, and catcher Jorge Posada, free agents, as is Alex Rodriguez, and talk that Red Sox, who tried to bring A-Rod to Boston 2 years ago, may try again. You know, is this the end of the Yankee evil empire? And then I have to say, by extension, maybe the beginning of the Red Sox?
Well, first of all, nobody who's paid any attention to Joe Torre ever bought that evil empire characterization, which I'm sure was meant in jest when Larry Lucchino made it to begin with. But Torre is the antithesis of evil.
A
great guy and a terrific manager, 12 years in a row to the postseason. It just doesn't get much better than that, his getting fired notwithstanding. But it will be interesting to see how many of those free agents you mentioned end up playing in Dodger blue instead of Yankee pinstripes. Torre, the Dodgers are one of the few teams that has the money to reconstruct itself along those lines. Very few teams can afford the top free agents, or at least very many of them. So it'll be interesting to see how that all shakes down.
Because they like him.
Mm-hmm.
We have to close with some sad news from the world of tennis. Martina Hingis, winner of 5 Grand Slam championships, retiring from the game after testing positive for cocaine. That's following her defeat earlier this year at Wimbledon. At press conference yesterday, she denied taking drugs and is calling it quits rather than spending years fighting doping officials. But this is tough exit.
Well, yeah, of course it is. The one thing that kind of occurs to me is that the test for cocaine has been in place for a long time. The test for human growth hormone and some of the things that athletes are only recently using may not be so reliable. I hope she'll be remembered as a triumphant tennis player who perhaps turned pro too young and burned out too early.
Bill Littlefield covers sports and more every week on NPR's Only a Game. Don't miss it this weekend. Bill, thanks as always.
Thank you, Robin.
And in 1 minute, the sounds of Brazilian singer-songwriter Seo. You don't want to miss that. Here and now.
Mm-hmm.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. The sounds of Brazilian singer-songwriter Maria do Céu Whitaker Poças. She goes by Céu. It means heaven or sky in Portuguese, and her career is taking off. She was nominated for a Latin Grammy as Best New Artist in 2006. Her self-titled debut album was at the top of Billboard's World Album Charts earlier this year. And you might have seen or heard her CD in your local Starbucks. It was picked up by the coffee chain as part of its Hear Music series. Sao Paulo, Brazil is her home, but Seo's in the States finishing up a tour, and she joins us now from the NPR West studios in Culver City, California. Welcome.
Hi.
The song we're listening to, it's called Lenda. Is that how you say it?
Yeah, perfect.
And it's a beautiful song, but we understand that actually the lyrics are that you are saying to a man, if he doesn't behave, he'll turn into a frog.
Yeah, the prince returned into a frog.
Well, it makes me think, too, that, you know, is there ever a disconnect for you while you're touring? Because you're singing about a man turning into a frog, but if you're singing in Portuguese, people might be swooning, or, you know, not knowing what the lyrics are.
Yes, I know it's a challenge, you know, to sing for people that don't understand what you're talking about. So it's really nice, though, because I think music is universal language, and somehow I feel that people can get the vibe of the song, you know.
I did not pick up the frog part of Lenda, just on the hearing. I have to ask you about your name, too, because I understand your father was a composer and a music teacher, and you grew up listening to Brazilian music, but your name has one anglicized portion, Whitaker.
Yeah, in Brazil, it's all about mixtures, and we have people from all over Europe, native Indians and Africans a lot, so it's kind of rare to find a genuine, a real Brazilian person, you know. Everybody's so mixture, and I am too. I have people in my family from England, people from Spain, and I'm such a mixture.
Well, but the basic sound, of course, is Brazilian. That was your early influence. Let's listen to Samba na Sola from your CD, Céu. Brasileiro, do banzo do pandeiro, calço qualquer calo mesmo, como bom guerreiro e lutador. Comigo não tem gravata e se acaso pego o trem errado, vou-me embora, mas Céu, what are you saying in this song?
This song is about dancing, samba. I'm just saying that it's, you know, nice to have this rhythm in our country. And samba in Brazil is a philosophy, is a behavior. So it's just a joke about, you know, being on this culture.
What do you mean by that? Samba is a philosophy.
Yeah, samba out of Brazil, it's pretty much this carnival thing, much more samba enredo, which is a very fast samba and a tourist samba, you know, with all the costumes. But in fact, samba, it's about another thing too, very beautiful melodies, not too fast that you can dance, you know. It's pretty much a way of thinking, you know, trying to get your bad things into good vibes, you know.
Getting bad vibes into good vibes.
I've
seen it danced in, you know, small, out-of-the-way places in Brazil by older people, and it's a very sort of dignified social get-together.
Yeah, that's totally, yeah.
Yeah. But you also lived in New York for a time. What are some of your other musical influences?
Jazz music, which I always loved, but also Ben Harper, I met this song, this great artist, Erykah Badu, Jill Scott, which I really, really loved.
Well, and somewhere along the way, you also discovered reggae. There's one song on the CD that's in English, and that's your cover of Bob Marley's Concrete Jungle. Let's listen to that. No sun will shine in my day today.
To be found.
Seo, Bob Marley was writing in that song about Kingston, Jamaica. What does it mean for you?
I was worried about recording this, such a classic, I know that, but I feel that if you somehow identify with that situation, I think it's good thing to sing. And São Paulo is such a, my city, São Paulo is such a huge and chaotic and a lot of pollution there. And this city inspires me a lot, this chaotic situation. And I just felt that I did my version to São Paulo, and I really love Jamaican music.
Well, you were singing about São Paulo, even though it was a Marley's song about Kingston, Jamaica, but then you've also written your own song about São Paulo. It's called Roda. Well, as we listen to a little, what were you saying with this song?
Roda talks about when you must find a way to survive in this crazy, chaotic organization, which is São Paulo, this crazy city. And it's finding an oasis inside of you. Consciência maior arma, mapa pra qualquer lugar. Tô na raia deslizando no concreto a recortar.
We're talking to Seo, a Brazilian sensation, really. I'm thinking, for a while you passed through Boston and it was your picture was everywhere and your CD is at Starbucks and your CD cover also appeared in a commercial for Apple's iPhone. I'm wondering, too, if that's how, you know, you reach new fans.
Yes, I'm indie in Brazil. I don't have any major deal, so it's been really, really wonderful.
You're independent.
Yeah, I'm independent. Huh. And it's great. I think it's just a picture of what it's going on now in the music industry, you know. An independent girl from Brazil here, and I just consider this a great opportunity to show my work.
Well, I want to do that also with one more song before we let you go. Let me try this now. It's Valsa pra Bio Hockey.
Yeah, valsa para biohockey.
Almost. This is a song that uses the bandolim, which is the Brazilian mandolin. It feels kind of old school, you know. Mm-hmm. What was your thinking here?
Valsa para biohockey means waltz to biohockey, which is a really old guy, 73. He has an album. And once I listened to a specific song, which I loved, you know. It's a love song, and he's talking about this Maria, this woman. And I love the way that he sang, and I'm Maria too, so I felt like that I was his Maria. And then I just did an answer to his song.
Hmm. And the new generation speaking to an older one.
Yeah.
And she is a Maria, Maria do Seo Whitaker Posas. Her stage name, though, is just Seo, which is also the name of her CD. She's finishing up a tour of the West Coast with stops in California, Oregon, and Seattle. For more, you can go to our website, here-now.org. And Seo, thanks so much for speaking with us.
Oh, thank you. It was a pleasure. Thanks.
You can listen to Here and Now live each weekday at noon Eastern Time by going to WBUR.org and clicking on the Listen Live button. You can also find us each weekday at noon Eastern on XM Radio Channel 133.